winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Coming up in a bit, we'll take a look at the concerns residents and elected officials in Westchester County have over the decision to close the Indian Point nuclear power plants. We begin the program, though, at the Reporters Roundtable, where we join my partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. We're at the Reporters Roundtable with Rick Carlin from my own fine paper, the Times Union, and an equally fine publication, Politico New York. We have Bill Mahoney here. Thanks very much for coming in. So it was a busy week, a week full of pressure for the Independent Democratic Conference, the 8-member breakaway headed by Jeff Klein, which this week was the target of a plea from Governor Andrew Cuomo that Klein needed to push harder for raise the age legislation, legislation that would boost the age of criminal responsibility in New York to 18. And the response was,
from Jeff Klein at the IDC, we're not going to vote for the budget unless we get raise the age. So to me, that could be either seen as a really tough bargaining stance or a way for the IDC to say, well, we're turning everything over to the Republicans unless they do this. If they're not going to do raise the age, well, the ball is in their court regarding the budget, and the Republicans get to vote on the budget. I mean, it's a little bit of a dicey move because they risk irrelevancy in budget talks if they really decide they're going to sit out the budget or sit out the vote on the budget right from the get-go.
The IDC,
it's very early to start playing these sort of games.
Chicken games
of
chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
The IDC needs a progressive win.
Yes, yes, they need
new
it,
members,
they
including
this.
Jose Peralta, have said, I really want to see the DREAM Act, which would expand educational funding for undocumented, the children of undocumented immigrants.
And raise the age, which would raise the age of criminal culpability. I keep hearing that the Republicans are not going to budge on this, although who knows. You know, the way it was described to me is once with a lot of the largely upstate Republicans is that law and order sells, and they know that, and they just feel like they don't want to give up on that. So
it's easier to imagine them budging on the raise of the age than on the DREAM Act. A lot of them campaign solely on like the threat that your tax dollars are going to go to illegal immigrants if Democrats control the chamber.
Yep.
So I think they're pretty immobile on that, and raise the age is probably
that would
one
be
progressive
the one that
thing
they
that
might
they
give.
Could negotiate.
And I think we were talking about this week, they might come to some sort of a middle ground on raise the age and call it a victory. Maybe they won't go quite to the extent that the governor wants or the advocates want, but they'll budge a little bit on that.
And these games of chicken that we talked about, that actually does provide some room for the Republicans too, because they could be like, this is what our IDC partners really wanted. This is what they're getting out of the budget. So.
Yeah. Okay.
The governor, of course, is a famous budger on things that he really wants to see accomplished. Mainline Democrats, of course, say we can't have a watered-down bill. They're placing their own sort of pressure on the IDC. Bill, you had a fascinating story on the relationship between the aforementioned IDC and the Independence Party, a party that many people say has no other reason for being other than people don't understand the distinction between being an independent, that is registered to no party.
And unaffiliated.
And being a member of the Big I Independence Party.
Yeah, that's become the latest reason for criticism of the IDC among the Democrats who really don't want this conference to exist. As you were getting at, the Independence Party is, I think it's one of the largest third parties in the country in any one state, just because the way that you register to vote in New York, if you don't want to belong to a party, you have to check a box that says, I do not want to belong to a party. But above that is the box for independence, and a lot of people register with this party thinking that that means they're an independent voter. But this party, it's had a long working relationship with Senate Republicans going back over the years. You could look at the Moreland Commission report and see details about their exchanges with Senate Republicans strategizing. They almost always endorse Republicans in competitive races throughout the state. And last summer, they created this fundraising apparatus where the IDC for years had struggled to find a way to raise money on an equal on an equal footing with Republicans and Democrats.
Because the IDC isn't a party.
Yeah, if you're a party, you can set up a party committee. You can raise effectively unlimited amounts of money from donors. But they were kind of stuck because they're, as you mentioned, it's not a party. So they had a PAC, but that had contribution limits. And then they tried creating a super PAC, but that couldn't really transfer money to candidates they wanted to support like parties could.
They have to raise the individual candidates.
Yeah, who have contribution limits of $18,000 a pop, which is a lot less than the $100,000 plus that a party can have.
Right.
So last summer they came to this agreement with the Independence Party where they created an Independence Party committee that lets them operate like a regular party.
Amazing. It's fascinating. We were trying to figure out what biologists would call a symbiotic relationship.
The shark with the parasitical.
The remora, yes.
The pilot fish. Yeah.
Rick, it's been an interesting week for the Justice Center for the Protection of People with Special Needs. Mm-hmm. The special agency set up to investigate cases of abuse and neglect of developmentally disabled or people in state care generally.
Right.
An audit from State Controller Tom DiNapoli said that the Justice Center was not forthcoming in providing unsubstantiated reports. The Justice Center responded that under state statute, we can't disclose unsubstantiated reports.
Right, and I mean the notable thing about that is there's more unsubstantiated reports. The Justice Center was set up a couple years ago to respond to problems at state institutions and residential centers where disabled people might be living and maybe they're subject to abuse and neglect, and they set up a hotline. So they get they field calls all day long about potential abuse and neglect. They have to check them out, but you know, a fair amount might not be substantiated. That might just be someone who's angry, or maybe it doesn't rise to the level of abuse or neglect. So they do have a lot of unsubstantiated reports, but by not giving the comptroller that, you don't really have a good baseline of what their so-called batting average would be in terms of closing cases and cracking down.
And you attended arguments in a court case where the very underpinning of the Justice Center's ability to prosecute was called into question.
Is in question. The Justice Center also oversees a lot of institutions, including the juvenile centers and special schools for troubled kids. There's a teacher who's accused of abusing a youngster in her class. And what emerged from this case is the defense lawyer said, well, wait a minute, the prosecutors for the Justice Center are unelected, and we believe that's unconstitutional. And the attorney general has joined on to that case, saying, well, we need to explore this because there could be a question of State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has joined on to this case, saying, yes, we need to make sure that this whole concept of a Justice Center where the prosecutors are essentially, it's a state agency, and so it's controlled by the governor. Is that really constitutional? Usually, prosecutors are district attorneys who are elected in their counties.
The governor over the weekend was in Israel. Did he accomplish what he set out to do, which was trade mission and statement of unity?
He's announced some new jobs, and I guess he expressed unity with Israel, so that's what he did. But it was a very brief tour. Like, I think I've spent more time at the mall than he had, like, in one weekend day than he did in Israel this year, this weekend.
As Jesse McKinley in the New York Times noted, there was more travel time than there was time on the ground in Israel.
Yeah, it was a really brief visit. But it's a place where New York governors go on a regular basis. It's one of the three I's, Israel, Ireland, and Italy. If you look at the traditional demographic bases of New York, mayors and governors have made a point of visiting there and speaking to that population.
I've never
frequently
heard that before, the three eyes. All right, well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Rick Carlin from the Times Union and Bill Mahoney from Politico New York. And now we'll kick it back to Matt at the desk.
Thanks, Casey. Earlier this year, Andrew Cuomo accomplished something in his home county of Westchester that he's been after for over a decade, the eventual closing of Indian Point. He says it's a big win for the people in and around the New York City area. But what about for those closest to the nuclear power plant? You might be surprised by their answers.
Governor Cuomo has detailed the problems at Indian Point through numerous press releases over the years, and this past fall surveyed the facility from the Hudson River after an oil spill on the property.
There have been over 40 extraordinary incidents. Since 2011, 40 extraordinary incidents. We've had tritium leaks, we've had steam leaks, we've had a fire in a transformer, we've had turbine failures, pump failures, weld failures, high levels of radioactivity in groundwater. So this plant is no stranger to dangerous situations.
Less than 3 months later, to the surprise of many, the governor announced an agreement to close the plant for good.
Indian Point is located in the most densely populated area of our state, and
in the most densely populated area on the globe. I'm proud to announce that we have an agreement. Indian Point will close in 4 years, 14 years ahead of schedule. It will close at no cost to the state. Our plan identifies sources of replacement power and transitions workers to new jobs. This agreement eliminates a major risk, provides welcome relief. New Yorkers can sleep a little better.
That might be the case for many parts of the lower Hudson Valley and New York City, but not here. This is the village of Buchanan, a quaint little spot away from the hustle and bustle of lower Westchester. It's just 1.3 square miles, 28% of which is home to Indian Point. The eventual closing of the plant means a loss of tax revenue for a number of entities, including the village of Buchanan. Half of the money in their budget comes from Indian Point.
I don't even want to say they were stunned, they were shocked. And everybody just took a deep breath in and go, is this for real or not? When you had to find out about it in the papers or online, there was no transparency whatsoever.
Local state senator Terrence Murphy grilled members of the Cuomo administration at a recent legislative hearing on the subject.
Can you tell me exactly who took part of the negotiations in the closing of Indian Point?
Who exactly?
Yes, who was in the room?
It was representatives from Entergy,
okay,
and members of the governor's office.
Okay. Anybody else?
And then at the very end of the process, included, since the purpose of the settlement was to close, to settle all litigation, then Riverkeeper as a party to litigation was included.
So you give new meaning to three men in the room, right? I'd like you to look at the mayor of Buchanan right over there, and the supervisor in Cortland, mm-hmm, and the superintendent of schools right over in Hendrick Hudson School District. That should have been in that room. To the Teamsters in the UWA and the people that are gonna be directly affected, they should have been in the room. How come?
Well, the negotiations needed to be kept confidential for several reasons. So the first is that I remind you, Senator, that these are parties in litigation. There was no certainty of an agreement. In fact, we didn't know until Sunday night the 8th that there was going to be an agreement that was subsequently announced on the 9th. And these were settlement of litigation negotiations, these were privileged conversations.
Entergy, the owner of the plant, has said that it just isn't economically viable to keep it open in the long term. Senator Murphy held a forum near Indian Point a few days after the legislative hearing in Albany.
Now, the governor has taken away more than 1,000 jobs directly, more than $30 million in local revenues currently generated by Indian Point, and replacing them with billions of dollars in costs to taxpayers around the state. At the same time, he's eliminating 2,000 megawatts of power.
Local leaders like Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino testified at the forum. The big areas of concern were the loss of jobs, the uncertainty of where their power would be coming from, the potential increases to their utility bills, and the biggest question of them all, how do they replace the tax revenue? In addition to Buchanan, the town of Cortland will lose a third of their annual revenue, the local library 28%, and the local fire department 65%.
We are all partners of what's called a pilot, a payment in lieu of taxes for tax stabilization. This revenue will end in a sliding scale once the plants are closed, and we are currently only in our second year of the 10-year pilot. So it's really, really difficult for us to wrap our arms around, as you can imagine. The job losses are significant. 1,100 permanent jobs plus part-time jobs, and many, many contractors are retained to work at Indian Point and all of these terrific union people as well.
The closure affects the local school district too.
As a result of this aggressively negotiated pilot, our property taxes are among the lowest in Westchester County. In fact, over the last 5 years, our property taxes have increased on average just 1%. No other district in our county can stake claim to that record of fiscal planning and responsibility in their school district. Therefore, taxing our way out of about a one-third revenue shortfall, or taxing our way out of a $29.7 million gap, cannot be an option for our community.
You, again, stated in your opening statement that this is going to pose a challenge, quote unquote, pose a challenge, that you said, with regards to the tax implications for what's going to happen over there. So if you've been looking to do something for over 10 years, wouldn't you have a plan?
Well, Senator, again, I want to point out that this is at the heart of the agreement was time to plan. There's no immediate impact. We have several years in which to plan. I would want to point out that in other examples of nuclear plant shutdowns around the country, communities have had as little as 4 months. So this is why we have quite a lot of time to plan and engage with you and all other stakeholders.
In the agreement, the Cuomo administration announced there would be continued employment at the plant through 2021, and Entergy has committed to offer workers here in Buchanan jobs at their other facilities across the country. In addition, the state will offer worker retraining and new skills and renewable technologies. That will be done through NYSERDA. Although the plant will still be operating for another 4 years or so, the clock is ticking for residents in Buchanan and the surrounding area, giving them an uneasy feeling of not knowing how their communities will survive this dramatic change.
We are not a wealthy municipality. According to the last census, we have 826 households, of which 621 are cost-burdened. Many of the seniors have lived here their entire life. Some are still living in homes they were raised in. They are concerned they will not be able to keep their homes and live here for the rest of their lives. They are also concerned about the value of their homes, which for many is their largest asset. It is important to put a face to this problem and how it affects real people's lives.
The governor created a task force to ensure compliance with the agreement. Senator Murphy is among a dozen people on that list, along with the local leaders you just saw. With one exception, though, Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino, who was defeated by Andrew Cuomo in 2014 and may challenge him again next year. Astorino joked at the hearing that it must have been an oversight. Time now for this week's New York Now poll question. Do you agree with the decision to close Indian Point? Let us know by logging on to our website, nynow.org. Would you like to see an extension of the millionaire's tax, is what we asked last time around. And the majority said yes. Carol in the Collar City wrote, "It is critical that the millionaire's tax be extended in this period when so much uncertainty exists in Washington." Another Carol, this one in Castleton, said, "It's not that I want to sock it to those that are wealthy. There needs to be a balance." And finally, Margaret in Catskill, "Wall Street may have recovered from the recession, but incomes below the millionaire level have not." We appreciate all the feedback. The website again is nynow.org. It is where you can find all of our past programs and follow links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll also find a link to the Capitol Confidential blog run by Casey and his crew at the Capitol. It can also be found at timesunion.com.
The Iditarod, the Boston Marathon, the Lake Placid Ironman. The world thrills at the names of these famous endurance tests. But in Albany this week, we mounted a slightly less exhausting effort that might be called the Lobbyist's Challenge.
Well, for better or worse, Albany is the center of New York state government. But when the legislature is in session and the sun goes down, it's also a hotbed of political fundraising. In the 2 months since the legislature convened in Albany on January 4th, there have been only 14 session days, but more than 40 legislative fundraisers. Now, if you bought a ticket to all of those, the total bill would have been more than $18,000. Plus, of course, whatever doctor's bills you might have imposed from eating all that finger food and drinking all those cocktails. But if you thought that was an intense level of fundraising, strap in, because the last 3 weeks of March, right before the state budget deadline, will bring another 27 legislative fundraisers with a total cost of more than $12,000. That's a lot of fundraisers, which begs the question, how do the members of Albany's donor class do it? With that in mind, we set out to find out if it's even possible to attend all of the fundraisers on a given day. This week, the legislature returned to Albany on Monday, a day in which there were seven fundraisers. The first of them was a $500 a head lunchtime affair held by Western New York Assemblyman Bob Oakes. But things get considerably trickier after dark when a dedicated lobbyist would have to attend six fundraisers in the course of 2.5 hours. Here's how you do it. You can start your evening at 5:30 here at the venerable Fort Orange Club, which is far and away the most popular venue for legislative fundraisers for members of both parties. The club is large enough to host multiple fundraisers in different rooms, which is why on this night, upstate Republican Senators Kathy Young, Mike Ranzenhofer, and Joe Robach can charge $1,000, $600, and $500, respectively, for their overlapping shindigs. Let's say you spend 15 minutes apiece at each one, which means you would hit the door at 6:15 for a brisk walk across West Capitol Park and back into the Capitol Complex to the Albany Room at the north end of the Empire State Plaza Concourse. This is where Bob Oakes had his $500 a head lunchtime event. Come nighttime, it was the scene for Jeff Dinowitz, an Assembly Democrat's $500 a head fundraiser. So budget about 25 minutes for travel and lobbying, and then we're off. To 90 State Street, a former bank lobby that in recent years has been refurbished as an event space. This is where the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee is holding its $500 a head Winterfest. By this point, it's past 7 o'clock, but don't worry, you've only got one more stop. The elegant new Renaissance Hotel just a block east of the Capitol, where Assembly Democrat Harry Bronson will hang out with you for just $500. Congratulations, you're done for the night. Now, none of this fundraising activity, busy though it is in any way illegal, though critics who decry the influence of money in politics do find it a little bit unseemly.
They include Blair Horner, legislative director of the New York Public Interest Research Group.
What could be more brazen than holding fundraisers for lobbyists that are asking for favors during the day and handing you money at night?
An expert on government ethics, Horner says these marathon evenings are nothing new.
I've seen as many as 18 in a night. We've been tracking these campaign fundraisers now for over 20 years.
18 in a single
night.
18 in a night. In Albany.
And so it's pedal to the metal for the blue-suited nomads of Albany as they make their way up and down Washington Avenue. They zip from place to place. They drop down their business card. They wave to the sponsor and move on to the next
one. You don't try and make a pitch. You literally just make your presence known. You're gone.
The fact that your card is there is all you really need to say.
Democratic Assemblywoman Sandy Galiff of Westchester has for years sponsored legislation that would outlaw fundraisers in Albany County during the legislative session. Lawmakers who represent the county would be exempt, of course.
It just seems to me that you're putting lobbyists right next to the legislature at a time when we're really actually voting on these things. The second half of the year, we're down in our district, we're not here voting. That's a good time to have a fundraiser instead of up here.
What about the argument that, you know, this isn't the Vatican, this is the place where these sort of political arrangements are done, where policy is made? Gosh, it isn't surprising that there would be so many fundraisers taking place right here. The recipient community is here. The donor community is here as well, whether it's, you know, advocates, lobbyists, you know, private corporations, friends, what
right.
have you.
Well, I've never had a party up here to raise dollars, but I've had a lot of people sitting just where you are lobby me on issues. And that's okay. People can come in, they can lobby in our office, they pull us off the floor of the assembly every time we're in session to talk about bills. We meet all the lobbyists in the halls and the elevator. We have an absolute opportunity to talk to anybody up here, and you don't have to exchange a check to do that.
Galef thinks the change would be applauded by good government groups as well as by lobbyists.
And I've heard their views on this too, dropping money every place. I actually think many lobbyists would prefer not to have fundraisers in Albany.
Well, Matt, total cost for Monday night 7 fundraisers, $4,100.
How about Blair Horner saying that once there was 18 in one night?
I can't imagine such a thing. Can you imagine the catering bill?
Probably would have made for a better story for us seeing you run and fast forward like that from spot to spot.
Maybe we'll do a part two. All right, well, we leave you today with an upstate rainbow. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.